distribute by the postal service. They served as a public space of exchange and today compose the fragmentary accounts of this unforeseen subterranean history, which was not announced or allowed to crystallize. Periodicals of various types, always precarious, newspapers, postal stamps, stamping, postcards, and a significant amount of who is who type of addresses list proliferated. At that time, there were many hybrid projects that joined United Mail Art with Artist Book. We are seeing one of these. It's Clemente Padin's project of a magazine Ovum. And the print was determined by the number of the participants who would send their works in the format and the quantity previously arranged after receiving an invitation letter. Loose sheets in envelope plastic bags, spiral bound together, confers the character of precariousness in this type of production. And we see here some examples of that. In 1974, the poets Torquato Neto and Vali Salomão launched the Solidition of Nave Louca. This is the publication that remained as a landmark of the epic countercultural production movement, a magazine that circulated among the poets' inventors who appeared in the 60s and 70s. The edition further relies on the participation of the concrete poets from São Paulo, Augusto Haroldo de Campos and Décio Pignatari. A magazine of art, cinema, graphic arts, which includes the works of artists such as Ligia Clark, Elliot Sica, musicians, Caetano Veloso, Gilberto Gil, filmmakers, Ivan Cardoso, among many others, which within the local composition, the countercultural movement. The relationship among artists, writers, and poets is staged by the use of language and frequently unites mail art and visual poetry. These are processes, ideas, indexes, maps, in addition to text projects for actions and situation. I just have some examples here with Paulo Bruschi, Equilibrio, Horacio Zabala from Argentina, and Edgardo Antonio Vigo, also from Argentina. If you see the instruction you have there, you see the context he's working on. And that was a card that was put together in the envelope that circulated. For the militant fellow himself must fill with his own blood this bottle bomb. Its constant activation will make the object vanish to cover his blood circulation detonating. Well, anyway, that was the sort of work we can find in this archive I work in. The task of preserving these works are frequently carried out with precarious, short-lasting media involves the reconstruction of intricate symbolic mesh that engenders them, in which they are inserted and includes the historical, political, cultural, and social context. Thus, preserving is reconstructing these other meanings, attributing significance, and finally, providing intelligibility. In the context of the museum, these works suggest pending problems to the curator, such as, for instance, themes related to the transitory nature of the artwork, to the real definition of the art object, to the dialectical relations between art and documentation, as well as the urgent necessity of new parameters for the documentation, preservation, exhibition, and keep of contemporary art, above all, a forefront to the new technological means used by artists. The archive of Uruguayan artist Clemente Padin is exemplary of the turbulent period that Latin American artists live in. His story is very trails the fact that in order to narrate this story, it's important to know the continent's political history. The lacunas in the archives, in this archive, are gaps revealing the blows that were taken and losing twice. The first time he lost his archive was he organized an exhibition that was supposed to be sent to Chile, but it was in the embassy waiting to be sent, and there was the Salvador Allende's democratic government was fall, and then he lost everything. And later on, in 1997, he was arrested by the military Uruguayan junta, and then he was imprisoned for 5 years. And the imprisonment of these artists mobilized the Mayo Art International Network to gain his release. Here you see the network working for his release. It has a work by Damaso Gas, an artist from Chile that was living in Venezuela at that time. And he did these cards, which is circulated broadly. So the history of many archives of artists in Latin America hold nothing linear or homogeneous, but it's marked by alarming events and clashes, so as not to speak of the recent migration from international acquisitions of entire collections and archives, exiled and sold to museums and metropolitan collections. The instruments of producing and reproducing these works are revealing factors of a determined sensuous form, characteristic of this recent past that we touched this morning. Typewriters, offset printing machines, portable mimeographs, household photographic amplifiers are the material evidence of production and reproduction from a profoundly tactile collective memory. A typewriter, for instance, is capable of developing individual marks by pressing one's hand on the key of the typewriter, characteristic of an intermediary moment between manual force and machinery. The mimeograph, which is in some places, like in Brazil those days, it had to be registered in the police department, and it was considered to be a weapon in the hands of social movement, is also an appropriate instrument for this moment. The manual force in reproducibility and its distribution by the postal service are the sensuous ramrods in the tactile form and the corporal sensibility of the artistic production and circulation. This is an important differential, I think, above all in these times that we live in, when physical archives migrate to digital records and visual networks, in virtual networks. Many of these works were not carried out for being exhibited in galleries and museums, but of being circulated hand to hand in networks alternative to the official system. Private spaces touch public space and the personal and political sphere mingle. It was not my chance that this type of tactile ensuing collective manifestation escaped from the legitimized circuits. At that time, some artists organized their own publishing house as a result of the intense movement of postal exchange, private archive store, at times very precariously. A significant part of this is still mostly covered memory of this contemporary art. Here we call Ulises Carrion, a Mexican who lived a number of years in Amsterdam. He was a poet, artist, editor, organizer of exhibition and his own catalogs, librarian and art critic. He founded Other Books and Soul, where he headquartered an international network of postal exchange in Amsterdam. He commented on his mix of book, shop, gallery, archive. I quote him, "Why should an artist open a gallery? Why should he keep an archive? Because I believe art as a practice has been superseded by a more complex, more rigorous, and richer practice, culture. We've reached a privileged historical moment when keeping an archive can be an artwork." This book we are seeing here was published by Bourges Press, that with Felipe Ehrenberg was running here in England, and in collaboration with other artists that decided to do this community of artist editors. And the documental character of Mayo Art produced personal archives of artists fed by the fluctuating network. Then came the dialectic among museum, library, home, archive, public domains in private spaces, where a significant parcel of this contemporary memory still is. The recent interest in this issue does not seem coincidental. The conflicts raised by this sort of conceptual production bring to the heart of the debate the whole of the museum in its social and political dimension, confronted with the object of art, its broader relations to the context of societies. In artistic publications, the precariousness of support like a simple offset page, photocopy page, or artisanal postcard suggests the dynamism of the proposition, opposing to the economic value of art. These publications strike the idea that it is not enough for the artist to intervene in an isolated product or in the page of a conventional magazine or newspaper, for instance. It's necessary to intervene in the medium itself. The fact is that in 1960s, and above all, in the following decade, there was an art market formed in Brazil as a result of the economic miracle insufflated by the military dictatorship. An artwork, a certain type of traditional artwork, was traded like corporate stock to feed a totally artificial effervescence. The art expectancy should correspond to the dominant taste officialized by the ruler classes. That's the whole another history that we should investigate on. That's why the repressive discourse dealt with eliminating the divergences and depoliticizing content, but supported, diffused, and stimulated a certain approach for cultural and artistic productions, such as the form of introjecting the premises of speech consistent with the dictatorship in force. But in the 1970s, the tactile circulation of the postal service and precarious means are concrete alternatives to a limited repressive context. The change in the meaning of networks is evident, and the role performed by internet is fundamental with a new sensorial relationship. In the world without computer networks, some artist projects have appeared that, in a certain way, ascends the futurist strategy revived by mail art of organizing collective actions. However, some differences are quite significant in the relation between the networks established by mail art and internet art, should be stressed. Some decades ago, there was a talk of internationalization, conceiving political and geographical boundaries as an objective reality. This was the territory of sensory, tactile, mail art by excellence. Today, under a financial paradigm, globalization assumes another less tangible geography, operating an unterritorialized interactivity. If, on the one hand, mail art and internet art present a relative proximity of proposals, in placing the economic value of art, privileging an exchange circuit, and raising issues regarding authorship. On a second plan, on the other hand, the potential outreach of the postal institution is, above all in peripheral countries, unquestionably more democratic than the digital network. The current attention driven at alternative strategies and tactics of production and distribution in the 60s and 70s make me think about what feeds this interest today, when this concept of network is more normalized and globally spread every single day by technocratic cultural premises. Many tactics of artistic resistance are quickly assimilated as marketing operations. And the potential critique of some artistic propositions is neutralized by the market, by the cultural institutions, converted into business guided by neoliberal policies. This mobilizing guerrilla art critique, strictly contrary to economic interests, which was moved away from the hegemonic poles of exchange, may bear witness of a utopia that throbs and might still throb someplace in the subterranean. Thank you very much.
I'd like to invite Cristina and Adrian to join me. Well, thank you very much. Cristina and Adrian for two very different papers on working the archive in terms of mail art. In Adrian's case, it's got a clear preoccupation with the media, with the medium itself, and the kind of presentations, the presentation possibilities, and also imaginative ways in which to propose interaction by the public. Well, Christina, clearly speaking from a kind of historical context, where there is a kind of clear political, you mentioned guerrilla kind of tactics, political engagement, but also the aesthetic relation through language with visual poetry and so on. Both of you mentioned examples of male art as instruction. And I think this kind of these examples point towards very different ways in which you were looking at this subject. In Adrian's case, I had a question in terms of your mention of a letter by, I think, Solowit, instructing how to paint these panels. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. I was kind of... my doubt was that whether you considered this letter instructing as male art itself or as a constituent part of a work of art to be displayed in a gallery. I think there's a kind of an interesting distinction there.
I mean, in a sense, it was a construct because obviously we had this wall drawing in the gallery. And somehow I had to link that with the male art exhibition that I was curating. And that was the problem. How do you do that? But, you know, luckily in Barbara Rice's archives, there were these postcards that, you know, Solowit had written. We had the photographs of the assistant in Italy drawing Solowit's wall drawing in a gallery with the instructions by his feet. So it was a construct. And as I said, I don't think anyone here would necessarily think of Solowit as a male artist. Mm. But it was trying to link those two practices together in some weird way that kind of mirrored both the instructional basis of what Solowit was doing with, say, Miyoko Shiomi, sending out instructions to a whole group of people on the Male Art Network and asking them to perform a particular performance, I guess, at a particular time, and then collating all those and creating a piece from that. So actually creating a collaborative piece from an instruction, from something that's sent out in the mail, and then becomes a collective artwork.
Yeah, which is quite similar to Christina's example. I think it was Edgar... yes, mm-hmm. where the actual letter containing instructions, is clearly the object itself. It doesn't it gives instructions for something else, but there is a kind of hierarchy that I'm trying to kind of investigate here between what Solowit and Vigo, for example, in which the medium is privileged in one case and less privileged in the other.
Actually, Solowit sending projects by the mail. It was not a mail art project. Mm. That's the difference. Mm. Because when it's a mail art project, you have the network in the front, the first thing. And then, of course, exchanging ideas and thoughts through the mail was very current at those days. So there are many projects, photographs, and statements that circulate through the mail, which is different. Mm-hmm. No?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Which kind of brings me on to something I kind of found slightly problematic with Adrian's presentation in terms of the way you were describing exhibitions of this medium. So the criteria you were using, which emphasized the medium itself rather than the practices, and it seemed that the practices and the types of different practices within this medium were kind of neglected by this kind of emphasis on the visuality that you mentioned.
I think that was the whole thesis of my paper, really, was to say that I don't think it's possible to adequately display correspondence art in a gallery, setting, because it's very static. You're not opening the envelopes, you're not communicating very directly with the person who's sending the mail art. It's just a visual art experience like every other art experience. So that's why I was trying to posit some other ways that perhaps mail art could be seen in a gallery setting that would give you some idea of the feeling of receiving something through the post from a mail artist. And so you have that two-way connection, and in fact you're actually in a sense completing an artwork that another artist has sent you. That was a difficulty that I was trying to put over in terms of displaying correspondence art in the Tate. Mm-hmm. I think we have constraints in galleries that we have to live with, in a sense.
Do you experience the same problems?
Yeah, because actually it brings to the front of the debate the whole of the museum, the idea of the autonomy of the artwork, the relationship between the artwork and the whole process, what it was about. In the end, with time. So we have to have historical time, the process of the timing of doing that, the whole context, which you cannot face or you cannot show in the traditional gallery. You have this idea of display. So this always is a problem. And for us as curators, I think we are also recreating or trying to re-elaborate when we learn through the network. All these characters that sometimes we have never heard about, but we see that they make sense against each other in a whole net. When you understand that, you see that you have to rethink about exhibitions, how to show. It's not just one postcard. It's the postcard and something else, and a book, and the context you have to explain. So it's text-based in the end. You have to put some text to give the context. And also, I always have problems with that. When I do exhibitions on postcards, I see how to show both faces because you have to see front and back. So I tried some things. For instance, I do some acrylic pieces that I put them like that so you can see front of it. But it still is an object. It was not about objects. So it's the whole dilemma how to face it. So it's part of...
I'm going to open to the public. Felipe.
Hello. I was just in Essex, and the Tate lent the university some... Thank you very much.
Your piece.
And it was quite interesting for me to... they lent them little pieces of mine that had to do with mail art and things like that that they have here in the Tate. And I came into this little tiny room, this chamber, which they actually, this show inaugurated, a little extra part of the gallery at the Essex University. It's a very, very nice, tiny gallery. And here I'm watching these three people with white gloves handling and mouthpieces almost covering their mouths and checking the light. And I'm looking at the things that they're going to show, and they're actually protecting photocopies. They're not even the originals, you know. And it made me think on how much do we want to fetishize an experience that is a live experience. I agree with Adrian that mail art should be in an archive and not in a gallery, and that people should relate to it. But I also think that if you want to show it as an experience, just photocopy the damn things. I mean, I have color photocopies and let people handle them. Now, there's some pieces that have elements like bones or cloth or staples or like that. So we have a whole class of craftspeople reproducing mail art facsimiles for people to have their live experience, if the live experience were so important. And everything else, the contents, because it's not only the back and the front, it's also the inside and the outside and different things. I don't think artists, I don't remember artists, us artists, doing anything to fetishize. I don't remember knowing anybody. I don't remember any male artist of my, or any female artist for that matter, of my knowledge, that made pieces to be fetishized. We did send pieces of wood with stamps on them, and we sent, sometimes we even sent tortillas with for stamps, and they got through. But it was never the intention to fetishize into a gallery object that would be later on bought, would be bought by somebody. Yeah. And I think that is an important distinction with that we should be able to bring across to a public. It's not, it's more the experience than the object itself. And I do think that they can be, for the Discrepancies exhibition in Mexico, La Era de la Discrepancia, Olivier de Brois and Cuauhtémoc Medina were freaking out because they wanted to make the centerpiece of a certain moment the 200 postcards I had sent from London to Mexico. That's in the Tate's announcement. Those 200 postcards have a reason to be. They existed because I didn't have any money to make a long, big piece of thing and send it to pack it and insure it and ship it, so I did it in postcards. But the other thing is that they didn't want to, I said, well, why don't you just take the photograph and do a facsimile of it? No, it has to be the piece itself, and they never showed it. Mauricio Marcin, who has a nice show up at the in Mexico City, one of the first shows of male art in Mexico, did just that. He put up the facsimile of these postcards, and they look great. So again, I think male art in general, 90% of male art is more of an is less about fetishism and more about the vehicle and how it got into your hands. Mm.
That's very true.
Susanna.
Yeah, I totally agree with Felipe. I think it's interesting that from the two examples here, that male art still interacting with its context was what Christina's doing is about conferring status on some works of male art that were hidden before, and it's about making a history visible again. And so they become like historical objects. And then here in the UK, we have a different set of issues, which is about making these things sort of democratically available. And it's all kind of revolving around the status of the artwork, whether you want to confer that status or not. Mm-hmm. And if it's wise to do that. But I think it's interesting because the works are actually still provoking this this issue. So they're not just dead or historical. But there's another point that I wanted to make, which is about exhibitions. And there's this idea of male art just circulating between artists and being very personal and intimate. And we were talking about public and private before. But actually, there was a very public aspect to male art practice, which was that exhibitions started to be mounted in the 70s. And so maybe it's not betraying the work art, the works of art so much if you're going to exhibit them, because they were being exhibited at the time. Maybe it's more about exhibiting historical male art works in the wrong context or something. But I'd like to have your opinions on that.
Yeah, it's the problem of making a selection, I guess. In previous examples, historical precedents, where there's an invitational male art exhibition, then the normal practice is that everything that arrives is shown, and there's no kind of curatorial decision making. And so I was wrestling with this when I was doing the correspondence show here. Because I had just those 15 by 5 boxes to fill, just exactly who I was going to put in there. So I had to make some very considered decisions about which artists to place in there. Some were more well known, like Pauline Smith. Others, I wanted to choose male artists from around the world. So there were Latin American examples, Japanese, Eastern Bloc ones. Because obviously male art at that time was also very political. It was a way, it was a kind of get out of jail card for a lot of artists. They could send their art to the Western world, so-called, mm-hmm. and it could be seen. So it's a way. It was a way of showing their work by posting it, through what was essentially a state apparatus. But they could use that, and I like the phrase politicization of the conceptual. I think that's very true for a lot of male artists at that time. That the way they could show their work was actually by posting it. And for individuals to open and, mm-hmm. and see it, and then for that to be displayed.
Yeah, it's true. And just getting back to Felipe, I think when you talk about male art today, you're talking about history. It's not about experience, direct experience anymore. And you talk about history, so how you're going to erase or keep this memory. How you're going to put inside or outside. That's about that, because male art movement is not there anymore. I mean, so that's the choice. You want to forget, or you want to keep. It's not about fetishization of the object like that. It's you want to keep, or you want to forget. And which is a terrible thing for Latin American countries, because male art happened at the same time of military dictatorships. And male art was a strategy for freedom. And there's a lot of oblivion in this area. Nobody talks about that. And it was an important strategy. So we can't forget. That's not about fetishization, but what we're going to talk about, what we're going to leave aside. That's something.
Is there another question here?
What I was saying has been... Is it on? Yeah, it is on. It was coming out of the last couple of speakers in a way. And the previous conversation about the male art sphere is about individuals' collections of male art, i.e. recipients or whatever, archivists. But the whole other dimension is male artists themselves organizing around themes and having exhibitions and producing documentation. And the rules of what I've called the academy, which I think is not totally acceptable, is that everything that's sent to a themed show is accepted, everything that is shown is exhibited, and every contributor gets a documentation of the exhibition. This is a very different kind of emphasis, and what it leads me to say is that there are archives of these individual exhibitions all over the place. And one of those archives will show you the breadth of people participating in this in the more democratic way. You'd need several of these exhibition archives to begin to put together the network, but that's what the network is. And one last comment about Adrian's problems with exhibiting at the Tate. I thought A to Z is the most arbitrary way of organizing anything, which was perfect. It seems logical, but it's not in the least bit logical. It's totally arbitrary, A, B, C, and that's what you needed, and I think it was perfect.
When I first moved into this country, I assisted lots of lectures about art. And one of the things I was very impressed with in the English language was this idea of addressing an audience. And talking about male art and how it's displayed made me think the more general this, the more audience you want to address, the less personalized. And I think maybe postal art is kind of a question that it's very specific, the person you're addressing. And I was impressed with the expression, addressing the audience, because I thought, how does that arrive to the audience? How does someone really feels that you are addressing them? And as a painter, I thought, it would be wonderful if I could address everyone. But in fact, the painting is there, seeing a lot of people passing in front of it. And maybe a few people feel that addressed, but not necessarily everyone. So in the display, in the museum, how does the museum treat this object is kind of a way of generalizing what seems at the beginning very personal and very directed. And there was I sort of felt for the man that talked about how the studio is always public. As a studio practice, I think everyone actually, as every artist actually feels that there's an audience that they want to address, even if they're working on their own. But that is like a general idea of the audience, whereas I suppose addressing in male art is completely different, just at that point. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any other questions? Or do you want to comment on these issues?
It's not really a question, but all of this discussion is making me think of a piece by Taras Kanto. I don't know if you know this Polish artist and this kind of procession he staged where he made a performance piece, really, which involved everybody, the public, that's to say, in a procession of a delivery of a letter to a gallery, the Foxhall Gallery, whereby he was kind of just addressing all of these issues we've been talking about in terms of public and private space and where art is situated and, you know, art as a product or maybe art as this action instead. So I just kind of thought that would be nice to bring up.
Perhaps we should compose a letter and have a procession out.
There's a project by Brazilian artist Paulo Bruschi that he did a huge envelope. That's a project on male art because it was thought as a performance, but into the male system. There's a kind of noisy in the male system. So he did a huge envelope with everything that should be in an envelope, back and forth, and indeed went with many people to the male office and tried to send it. So that was an envelope, there was the address and the sender and everything. And so that was the performance, the limits and things. And then they photographed everything of that. So the huge envelope and the procession to the mail, a post office, and I mean.
Do you think it's died out? Sorry, I don't really know about mail art, so it's found out about it today. But has it died? Are you saying it's died out? Currently, you know,
yeah, it's no. Different because it has to do a certain period from the end of the 60s until the beginning of the 80s, which how I see the timeline of this, where we can see the movement itself. I don't know if you agree with me in terms of time.
I mean, what tended to happen was that male artists, just at the beginning of the computer age, as the internet was coming in, they could. And a lot of the countries that the repressive countries that they'd been in had relaxed to such a degree that male artists started to do male art tourism. Yeah. So they would go and visit other male artists and have their photographs taken, and then they'd post those on to other people. And then there were also male art congresses where male artists in various different parts of the world, I think 300 locations, for a certain period of time, they had a decentralized male art congress where all these male artists met in their own countries and discussed whatever they wanted to discuss. So it started to move outwards from just the postal system. And I guess then the internet came in and that became all pervasive. But I'm sure there are still some male artists out there. There may be some in the audience here today, I don't know. Clive's probably still one.
No, I'm not actually. Sorry. Yeah, I was just thinking about this transition period between male art and the internet, and I was thinking about maybe, I can't remember your names, but maybe you remember. In the early 90s, I was about 12 or so, and we'd started to get, kind of had a home computer. It was kind of a novel thing. And basically, people used to send internationally discs, little 3.5-inch floppy discs, and they would have work on them, and they would have it would be mainly programming, but it would also be communications and letters. I just thought I'd
bring that up as maybe a point at which male art met the internet, but it was before the internet actually existed.
There's also the people that, just a little, that now are designing their emails, and they use typography, and they use colors, and they use this. There's still things, you could just look at them or print them, but it's not just the writing of an email. It's the designing and the centering of letters and making larger for emphasis in red or pink or whatever it is, using colors. That is also, that also exists as email art. Mm.
But in a sense, it's very two-dimensional or even ethereal. I mean, mail art is very three-dimensional. I love the fact that you can post a piece of wood, or in the archive we have a toasted sandwich that was posted. You know, we've kept that very carefully in an acid-free box. The conservators have seen it. And so that hopefully will be here for the next conference on mail art in 100 years' time. So, I mean, that's the other thing that museums have to consider, that they have to keep things for an awfully long time to make sure that mail art isn't forgotten, and that it does inspire a new generation of artists as well to send things to each other three-dimensionally through the post.
Yeah, I'm just remembering this anecdote about a town in Indonesia. I think I can't remember the place exactly, but then they would have no... There was a lot of migration outwards, and they had no internet connection, so they had like a community center with a single computer on it. And what people would do is like they read the emails in this computer, and then there was like an actual mailman that passed by the town and grabbed all the mails, all the emails from this computer to this single computer, and it would spread them all around the world. And that was done without even touching the computer. I mean, it was done like Wi-Fi, I guess. I mean, just an anecdote. It's a funny one, I guess.
I mean, maybe mail art is a key way for artists in the third world, developing countries, to create works. Maybe that will be an expanding area for mail art. Africa and Asia and other places where there's no access to computers.
There's a question.
Hi. You mentioned before that postal mail is more democratic than its digital counterpart. And both of you have put emphasis on three dimensions. I was wondering if both of you feel that tangibility is more important than mass availability.
I said it's more democratic in some countries like in Latin America, the access to computers and internet, if you think about the whole population, how the percentage of people that can access computers. That's what I was saying, that the mail was more democratic in this sense, and it still is. And this tactile aspect, I think it's something important to think. The type of relationship that was being established was like hand to hand and was not done to be exhibited in museums or galleries. It was a form of contact, as we just have these examples. It's a form of being together, exchanging, and had to do with, you know, this net. And you can name what kinds of nets we have now. You have many types. But this kind of tactile was part of that time. I think that's an important issue to think about. And it has all the kind of machines that were being used to produce this sort of collective memory, engagement, and forms of exchanging that nowadays, of course, we do is that we put in the walls and we show in exhibitions, but of course it was not the original sense of it.
Mm. And I think with the internet, obviously you can blind copy to other people who you may not want things to go to. With a piece of mail art, it's a direct communication with one other person. I think that's the key thing. And it goes back to the public-private issue.
What I think it's important is that it was used as a strategy. Mail art was used as a strategy in Latin America and Eastern Europe. When we see archives in Latin America of artists' archives or museums' archives, because the museum I talk about is not just an archive that was buying things or has been buying things now. No, it was a net important point of this network. Artists were sending there the material. So everything I showed here was sent to the museum to be shown on the exhibitions in the 70s. So it was a point of this net. And you have to make the map of this net work so you can see how it's been used. I was really impressed when I started to work with this material. I saw so many works from Eastern Europe that nowadays, that everything's open, we could say like that, we have much more information. I don't know so much about so many artists as I could know about from this archive that has been sent in the 70s to Latin America. So it was a strategy of communication, which is very important to know about because it was something that was going on beyond what was going on in political regimes, military dictatorship in Latin America and communist in Eastern countries. So you see, beyond that, you see a strategy for freedom, which is very interesting.
Was there kind of direct communication between those artists in Latin America and those artists in the Eastern Bloc?
Some were direct communication, yeah. Some, although they never met. Personally, but they exchange a lot.
There was this visual poetry element present in this communication.
Yeah, sometimes, You have, for example, Paulo Brusque and Robert Heyfeld that was living in Eastern Germany. So you have some artists that were exchanging directly and never made contact personally. And you see that they are going with the same kind of sense of freedom, I think. I can read through this key. I mean, they were looking how to go beyond the situation. You know.
Kind of goes back to Felipe when he, this morning, talking about the other eye in the pillowcase. You know, it is that other eye, that it's all that work that's going on by artists that no one sees. It bypasses the whole museum gallery system.
Yeah. And what I see with these artists, most of them, they are not so well known in Latin America, most of these names, because they were working hard those days. But they were doing something that was not so legitimized by the mainstream circuit. So they were kept apart. And now, 5 years from, I see, they're coming back. They've been publishing about them, the book on Felipe Ehrenberg, the book on Paulo Brusque. So the necessity of publishing what they've done the whole life, and sometimes they have nothing about it. And so time is coming back for them, I think, in terms of recognition. And it has to do with all this kind of interest in something else, which is not the art object, fetishized, fetish as a fetish, but as this process, this network, this other thing, I think.
I think Gabriela had a question, and then Matthew.
Expand on this idea that, or maybe just contradict this idea that from mail art we go straight onto the internet and it's a big jump. It's not really that clear because I remember Leon Ferrari telling me that when he moved to São Paulo due to the military dictatorship in Argentina in 76, he encountered a group of artists, among them Regina Silveira in São Paulo, who were working with the Minitel, which is something I encountered only in France. It was like a little computer in the 70s. That wasn't like a computer. It was like a monitor where you could do searches for, like, you know, bookshops, restaurants. And they used that as a medium to put visual poetry in it, to work with words as material. And also they used television. I don't know how they did that. He never explained. But they used television to insert messages. In there and expand to bigger audiences, and he also at the time was making these heliographs that were signed to infinite. So he was making unlimited editions of this work that he would then fold and put in an envelope and send around, and that was his idea of distribution and marketing, not marketing but distributing the ideas. So I think that it's not just, you know, it's either mail art or the internet. There are many things in between that artists with their unlimited imagination used to distribute their ideas, and there's more to it.
That's right.
Mm. Matthew had asked before, and then Isabel.
Thanks. Actually, I wanted to quickly go back to that question of freedom that you were talking about just now. Because although I'm very sympathetic to the idea of conserving these works, and particularly, as you outlined, in regard to honouring the memory of those people who have suffered so terribly under dictatorships where these kind of tactics for freedom were so powerful and important in those repressive regimes. But I wonder if there's a problem inherent in the very idea of male art that, as you were both outlining, this is a mechanism that addresses one individual to another individual, when in the contemporary context, as I was discussing earlier, it is in fact the very idea of individuality or the individual as a particular kind of subject or a particular kind of subjectivity that is, of course, the core ideological subject of both capitalism as it exists and, of course, liberal democratic states. So on the one hand, you could see if you're trying to be free from a dictatorial state, the subject that is the individual is a very useful ideological category to try to be free from the collective of the repressive state. But the situation we find ourselves in now is one of a kind of illusory freedom, one could argue, from particular sort of post-Marxist point of view. And so it is potentially, I'm just trying to see what lessons can be held in the present that continue to be useful, because I think they probably are, but I just can't quite locate what they are in male art just right now.
I think perhaps we've concentrated on just the individual to individual, but of course it was an eternal network, and quite often male art pieces would be posted from one person to the next, to the next, to the next, and it was almost like a surrealist game that was played, that artwork was added to and progressed through the network to become something completely different. So it became a collective thing rather than an individual thing. And it was almost, it was set out in a way, you know, the first artist who sent the mail art piece would not know what that piece would end up looking like if they did at all. Some might still be circulating the network, who knows. And Robin Crozier did a very interesting book called Portrait of Robin Crozier, where he asked people who'd never met him to draw up his portrait and send it to him. And so he had all these portraits of people who never met him, and he created an artist book from that. So, and the other way around, yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
In my situation, how I see things through the Museum of Contemporary Art collection was not a artist to artist. These works arrived in Brazil. They were sent to the Museum of Contemporary Art to Walter Zanini, to Zanini, who was the director of this museum, but to participate in the exhibitions he was organizing there. It was not for his own, like he's going to send back something. That's something important. He was not sending back anything. He was receiving it for exhibition. So the first thing, there is an exhibition intention. The artist was not sending to exchange. They want to show. And they want to show in a public sphere, because these were the exhibitions that he was organizing those days. So I think there are some issues to think. What Gabriela said is very important. It's not just about male art. It's a strategy of circulation. And it could circulate many sorts of items and material which was not male art strict sense, strictly speaking. You know.
One final question.
I just want to check something. I really hope that I misheard, but I kind of got the impression that it was being suggested that somehow the use of male art in... I think the term used was third world. I'm not sure if that word is used very much these days. Was something to do with a kind of lack of technical expertise in third world countries. But I don't know if the two artists who work with internet art, who earlier might agree with me, but I was actually under the impression that the leading web artists of this present moment, most of them are in Southeast Asia. It's not really a question of geography. And I'd be really concerned if a suggestion was being made that mail art was a kind of third world aesthetic, or they're cheap materials, so therefore it can be used. I just found that kind of... I just thought I misunderstood it, but I just thought that that was being suggested, that there was somehow kind of presently still a lack of access to technology in the third world. And I don't, and I think that what Gabriela was saying about the use of the Minitel in Brazil, Brazil has always been a pioneer of technology. So can we just be careful about how we divide these material notions? Because they're very persistent notions that kind of need to be got rid of.
But what do you mean? I don't understand. I did not address anything
no,
like
no,
that.
No, I think it was Adrian who said that that perhaps people... Sorry. Can we start talking honestly now? I think it was Adrian who said that perhaps the use of mail art in third world countries was because they couldn't like find plugs for computers or something. I mean, I just am really concerned that impression might have spread throughout the room.
I'm also talking about repressive regimes, you know, say like South Korea... You know, there's a possibility there of using mail art if you don't have access to the internet. Or if you are in a very remote area and there isn't access, then
it's not geographical, that's
within. It could happen here, it could happen in the Western Isles, I agree.
I just think the words first world, second world, third world don't make any sense in the context. I mean, we should stop using them in places like this, which, you know, but we're supposed to be in take modern kind of leading thinking on this.
Well, I have to say I did my first degree was in Asian African geography, so those were the terms that we were using at that time.
Yeah,
so,
sure
yeah, fair point. That's fine.
One final question. We're out of time, but I'll be generous and.
An anecdote, really. I went to visit Ulysses Carrion's archive in Amsterdam and see him and so on. And when I got there, I said, I keep hearing these stories that you're going to sell your archive. And he said, and he finally confided in me. He said, this is a rumor piece. I decided to set this rumor going, and it's gone all the way around. It's come back to me from all over the world. And then the follow-up to this is, after he died, I was giving a lecture in Geneva, and I said, I understand that a book dealer in Geneva is selling Ulysses Carrion's archive. And it was a guy called Juan Agios. And I got to meet him. And I said, how come you're selling this archive piece by piece? And he said, Ulysses left it to me in his will. I'm a bookseller. I'm dispersing the archive. And I think the idea that Ulysses brought it together and then it's dispersed again is very beautiful. It may not be appropriate for archivists, but very poetic.
I think on that note, I'd like to thank everyone for coming. Susanna, Gabriela, Tate's Modern for organising this event. And thank you, Christina and Adrian, for...